Srila Prabhupada ki. At the end of the Dharapajuga, I studied this great supplement of Vedic literature named Srimad Bhagavatam, which is equal to all the Vedas from my father, Srila Dwaipana Vyasadeva. The statement made by Srila Shukadeva Goswami that the topmost transcendentalist, who is beyond the jurisdiction of regulations and restrictions, mainly takes to the task of hearing about and glorifying the personality of Godhead, is verified by his personal example. Sukadeva Goswami, being a recognized liberated soul and the topmost transcendentalist, was accepted by all the topmost sages present in the meeting during the last 7 days of Maharaj Parikshit. He cites from the example of his life that he himself was attracted by the transcendental activities of the Lord, and he studied Srimad Bhagavatam from his great father, Sri Dwaipana Vyasadeva. Srimad Bhagavatam, or for that matter, any other scientific literature, cannot be studied at home by one's own intellectual capacity. Medical books of anatomy and physiology are available in the market, but no one could become a qualified medical practitioner simply by reading such books at home. One has to be admitted into the medical college and study the books under the guidance of a learned professor. Similarly, Srimad Bhagavatam, the postgraduate study of the science of Godhead, can only be learned by studying it at the feet of a realized soul like Srila Vyasadeva. Although Sukadeva Goswami was a liberated soul from his very day of birth, he still had to take lessons of Srimad Bhagavatam from his great father Vyasadeva, who compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam under the instruction of another great soul, Sri Narad Muni. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed a learned brahmana to study Srimad Bhagavatam from a personal Bhagavata. Srimad Bhagavatam is based on the transcendental name, form, attributes, pastimes, entourage, and variegatedness of the Supreme Person, and that it is spoken by the incarnation of the personality of Godhead, Srila Vyasadeva. Pastimes of the Lord are executed in cooperation with his pure devotees, and consequently historical incidences are mentioned in this great literature because they are related to Krishna. It is called Brahma Samhitam because it is the sound representative of Lord Krishna. Like the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita is a sound incarnation of the Lord because it is spoken by the Supreme Lord. And Srimad Bhagavatam is a sound representative of the Lord because it was spoken by the incarnation of the Lord about the activities of the Lord. As stated in the beginning of this book, it is the essence of the Vedic desire tree and the natural commentation on the Brahma Sutras, the topmost philosophical thesis on the subject matter of Brahman. Vyasadeva appeared at the end of the Dwapara as the son of Satyavati, and therefore the word Dwapara Adal, or the beginning of Dwapara, in this context means just prior to the beginning of Kali Yuga. The logic of this statement, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, is comparable to that of calling the upper portion of a tree the beginning. The root of the tree is the beginning of the tree, but in common knowledge, the upper portion of the tree is seen first. In that way, the end of the tree is accepted as its beginning. Om Agyan Samirandasya Jananjanan Shalakayo Chakshuram Minitan Jina Tashmai Sri Krima Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vashari Gaur Bhakta Prinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So here, we are getting a glimpse of how we should actually study the Srimad Bhagavatam. And Shukadeva Goswami has given his own example that even though I was situated on a transcendental position, still I had to hear from my father the Srimad Bhagavatam. I had to go and accept a guru to hear about the pastimes and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And my father also, he had to take instruction from his guru, Narad Muni. So this is the science of understanding Srimad Bhagavatam. As Prabhupada points out, it's not just that you can buy the books and read them, but you have to hear from the self-realized souls and to get the full understanding of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the Srimad Bhagavatam is such an important literature. Prabhupada said the Srimad Bhagavatam is sufficient for the deliverance of humanity. No other book is actually necessary. Only Bhagavatam will be sufficient. Because Bhagavatam is kicking out all the cheating religions. Even Vyasadeva admitted that. I was compiling all the Vedic literatures, which were dealing more or less with karma, artha, dharma, and moksha. That's religion, economic development, sense gratification, and ultimate liberation. And practically that's all the Vedas deal with. Therefore Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says, Nestvegun Mabajun, try to rise above the three modes of material nature. Because the flowery language of the Vedas, because they're dealing with the three modes of material nature. So try to come above them. So the great transcendentalists, they try to rise above the three modes of material nature, and the perfected souls, like Shukadeva Goswami, who transcend the modes of material nature, they become liberated, still they have to go further. Even though it's considered in the Vedas to be the last goal. But ultimately, the ultimate goal is bhakti. So even though he was liberated, he reached the platform of moksha, the final goal of the Vedas, still he had to take lesson from a devotee of Krishna and hear the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is the way that we have to understand the Srimad Bhagavatam. Otherwise the fruit will not be there. And Srimad Bhagavatam is so potent because it starts on this point. What is the duty of a person who's about to die? And where is there any other literature like this? There's no other literature like that that begins like this. Or practically even mentions the subject matter. But it begins with this point practically. And then Sukadeva Goswami, so you don't just skip over it, you read the first, yes, what is the duty of a person who's about to die, and then just read through and get on with the book. He stops Maharaj preacher. That's a glorious question. It's a glorious question. So he makes you think about it. He doesn't just go over and start answering. No, it's a glorious question. It's glorious because it's beneficial for the whole of humanity. Then he begins to hit the glorification of Srimad Bhagavatam. But he's always makes the point clear that the real purpose of human life is come to the point of bhakti to Krishna. It's not for any other purpose, karma, artha, dharma, or moksha. It's meant for devotion. And it's stated so clearly in the Srimad Bhagavatam that no one can refute it again and again. It just does not get away from this point of devotion to Krishna. And Ved Vyas wrote it in this way because he understood that all my other literatures I've compiled are simply confusing people from the real purpose of life. Therefore, I will not make this mistake again. And I'll just write the pastimes of the Lord, the activities, the relationships with the devotees. And this way, people will not be cheated anymore. And so Bhagavatam actually is another chapter here. Bhagavatam is the answer to all the answers, all the questions. It solves all the problems of life. And it is such a great book. Srila Prabhupada would immediately quote Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita. When he was speaking with devotees, he would always, generally, he'd always quote Srimad Bhagavatam. When he was meeting non-devotees, he would generally he'd always quote Bhagavad Gita. Immediately, he'd just quote Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita. But with the devotees, he would quote more Bhagavatam. Because Bhagavatam it defeats all the other philosophies. And establishes that devotion to Krishna is the topmost position to be in. I was just reading this story of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and how he was talking to one Professor Suthers from the State University of America. He was studying comparative religions. And he came to meet Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And he was asking him questions. And he was asking the typical questions that the Christians will ask about Hindu mythology. But in every question, Bhaktisiddhanta immediately just went to Bhagavatam. He answered from Bhagavatam. He didn't get off. He just said the Bhagavatam again and again and again. And he completely defeated this philosophy. Anyway, I read a part of it because it's very interesting how the whole tactic he uses and how he finishes the whole thing to show how one should approach Bhagavatam and appreciate Bhagavatam. This is from the Ray of Vishnu book. And there's a little thing here from Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He wrote in the Bhagavad, its philosophy, its ethics and theology. It's just a little introduction to what it was like during that time here in Bengal. So he gives a little dialogue here. And he says, what sort of thing is the Bhagavad? Asked the European gentleman, newly arrived in India. His companion tells him with a serene look that the Bhagavad is a book which his audio bearer reads daily in the evening to a number of hearers. It contains a jargon of unintelligible and savage literature of those men who paint their noses with some sort of earth or sandal and wear beads all over their bodies in order to procure salvation from themselves. Another companion of his says, well, he would contradict him and say that the Bhagavata is a Sanskrit work claimed by a sect of men, the Goswamis, who give mantras, like the popes of Italy, to the common people of Bengal, and pardon their sins on payment of gold, enough to defray their social expenses. And a third gentleman will repeat another explanation. So young Bengal, chained up in English thought and idea, and wholly ignorant of the pre-Mohammedan history of his own country, We'll add one more explanation by saying that Bhagavat is a book containing an account of the life of Krishna, who was an ambitious and immoral man. This is all he could gather from his grandmother, while yet he did not go to school. Thus the great Bhagavat ever remains unknown to the foreigners, like the elephant of the six blind men, who caught hold of the several parts of the beast. But truth is eternal, and is never injured, but for a while by ignorance. So he's setting the scene out, and he gives the example of the six blind men went to see, there was an elephant. They said, "What's an elephant?" They said, "I'll take it." So he said, "This is the elephant." So they went and they were, one touched his leg. He said, "Oh, elephant, yo, it's like a big tree trunk." Another one touched his tail and he said, "It's a long thing with hairy on the end." Another one got hold of the trunk and he said, "No, it's a rubbery kind of hose." Another one got his ear and said, "No, it's a flabby." The other one tried to get, "No, it's just like a big house." So they all had different opinions because they're all blind. So Bhaktivinoda Thakura has given his comparison. How blind men will just have their own conception of Bhagavad. So Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta says to this day, although Indian pride in their great culture and religious antecedents, it's more developed due to the efforts of Bhaktivinoda Thakura and Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Saraswati Thakura. Yeah, in other words, he said the Bengalis, in particular the Indians in general, have largely been made into foreigners in their own land due to the British Sanskritists and educators who have portrayed Vedic literature and culture of something recent, barbaric and inferior. Srila Prabhupada once commented, by this tactic, the British were able to do more harm to Indian culture and religion in their short period of rule than the Mohammedans were ever to do in a much longer one. Radha Madhav Ki. The Mohammedans practically have been ruling Asia for the last 1,000 years, I guess. They were most prominent. And in that 1,000 years, at least they stuck to the Bhagavad Dharma very rigidly. But when the Christians came, in a few short years, they deceived them and told them that they're just foolish. It's all mythology and you should follow the West, it's our advancement. And they completely fooled them and they changed them. In a few short years, the British were here. Then all the thousand years that the Mohammedans were ruling. And actually they had that philosophy that I think Lord Mountbatten, he said, "You can do what you like in India," to the Viceroy, "but don't interfere with the religion." So they kept away from the religion, but they just promoted their religion as much more superior. So anyway, this professor, he came to see Srila Bhaktisiddhānta Saraswati Thakura, and he started asking these difficult questions at that time, because there was one Max Müller, great Sanskritist. I think he may have been German. Was he German? German. And he was in India, and he was employed actually to defeat the Vedic Shastra, because he was one of the first persons who really understood Sanskrit. So he would try to refute all these stories, and then he would come up, it's all imagination, you know, there's oceans of milk and oceans of liquor and oceans of ghee, and you know, there's these men with different heads, and you know, it's all a big mythology. And so he was a leader. They actually had one time in India that during the British rule, they would give big money grants and donations for anyone who could defeat the tenets of the Veda. So you had to learn Sanskrit. But if you could defeat it, different points of Veda, you get big money. So it's quite a popular thing. In this way, the British were trying to undermine me. And they were quite successful, unfortunately. So anyway, this professor is coming from that time where, you know, the Christians are the only true humans and all the others are heathens. And so the first typical question he asked, he said, did the worshippers of Krishna encourage the obscenity of the engravings on many Hindu temples? Because on temples there are many erotic sculptures and things like that. People used to worship the sun and things like that. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says, those who are actually worshippers of Krishna, they are never in favor of indecencies. All decency and morality are entirely confined to the lotus feet of Krishna. The highest sense of morality of the unadulterated soul consists in love towards the oversoul. And culmination of this pure love is found only in the devotees of Krishna. The best of the moral rules, as preached by the noble Jesus, do not come anywhere near the principle of amorous love of the devotees of Krishna for service thereof. The professor says, your holiness seems to have taken a biased view in saying that the good moral precepts of our Christ come nowhere near the moral amorous love of the devotees of Krishna. But he says, certainly not. We claim to be greater and better Christians than the Westerners. He said, if Christian morality is perfected, thereby it may be said to receive proper nourishment. On the other hand, all moralities, they wait like maids with folded hands behind the spiritual moralities. And they become glorified by standing behind the spiritual moralities of Krishna. So then he says, how can you... Of course, Bhaktisiddhanta goes on, I'm just cutting this short, he goes on with so many logical arguments to defeat him. Then he says, how can your holiness's statements be reconciled with the descriptions that are found about Krishna's amorous sports? And then he says, Krishna's amorous sports are not temporary, like the lustful sports of dramatic heroes and heroines, like Romeo and Juliet, or even ideal spouses. Lust as prevalent in this world is only a mental passion, but the lust of the transcendental region as its own form. Then he goes on to describe the difference between like gold and iron. Lust is pure, it's like gold. And he tells him the difference. And he completely defeats the professor, so he changes the subject. And then he says, the Gita has admitted doctrine of transmigration of the soul. What does your Vaishnava philosophy say about this? And Bhaktisiddhanta said, the Gita is not separate from Vaishnava philosophy. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it has been fully revealed the true import of the doctrine of the changing of birth for the soul. So immediately he quotes Bhagavatam, then he goes on to quote, he quotes from the Bible, how they're also talking about reincarnation in the Bible. He quotes from all the Greek philosophers, the Roman philosophers. He starts quoting the modern philosophers and philosophers from Germany and everywhere in the world. He's quoting all these philosophers with different statements backing up that they believe in the science of reincarnation. So this professor's kind of really taken aback, you know, he's thinking just a Hindu thing, but then he points out actually it goes on all over the world. They're all accepting this reincarnation since long time. Then he finally concludes, he says, the conclusion in this respect of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is fully flawless and significant. The Vaishnava philosophy, having shown the royal road to the acquirement of the highest blessedness, even in the present life, there is no need of waiting for future lives. As such, the Vaishnava philosophy is thoroughly aloof from all the wranglings of useless riddles over the doctrine of transmigration. In other words, he's saying the philosophy is so great we don't even bother about worrying about and discussing transmigration of soul because we're going back to God in this life anyway, so it doesn't really concern us. This is the greatest of Vaishnava philosophy. Even then he says, because he keeps defeating him, and this professor says, "Oh, I'm able to feel the super excellence of the Vaishnava philosophies among the Indian philosophies, but to my mind, the acceptance of idolatry in the Vaishnava philosophy, like the other Indian philosophies, seems to be a stigma. This is the big Christian thing. Shouldn't worship any idol. Idol worship. So it's all, everything is idol worship, any form." So immediately Bhaktisiddhanta comes back. He says, "Idolatry has never been accepted in the Vaishnava philosophy. But on the other hand, it's been more or less accepted in all the other philosophies and religion. Because they've all got something they worship. They worship crosses, they worship the wall, they worship the fire, they worship, they've got some object of worship." He said, "But we don't actually worship idols, but practically all the other philosophers and religions, actually they've got some worship, they worship idols." So then he goes on to describe Sri Murti, how the Murti is non-different than Krishna, if it's according to the authorized description. So how can those that have not in their heart love of God, which is the true function of the soul, and is the science of true knowledge of realities, think of the Sri Murti other than idols? So he brings them to that point. If you don't have love, you're not going to ever understand. So then he goes on speaking about different types of idols and how they worship idols in different parts of the world. And then he starts talking about anthropomorphism. And he said, actually he says the Mayavadis, they have this idea also. He said Mayavadi is the evil fruit of India. You see? So, he said that in imitation of the Mayavadis, this anthropomorphism has come. He said it was invented actually in Greece and Rome. That's where it's actually coming from. It's not an Indian thing. It's actually coming from Greece and Rome and in Egypt. So then he starts talking about different avatars, how they're coming, and the central morphism means the Lord can come in different forms, animal forms and things like that. And then this professor says, in the scriptures of India, adorable deities have been represented as creatures of the lower creation, like fish, tortoise, boar, etc. Is this approved by the sense of decency of civilized humanity? So he's saying, how come you're worshipping the Lord in low forms like fish and pigs? This is this is against the sense of decency. So you see, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarodaka, the imagination, it doesn't find its place in Vaishnava philosophy or in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the highest scripture for all men in the universe. It has been described as the topmost ontology about God, millions of times better than what the most civilized races of humanity, 5,000 years old, nay, as many as several millions of eras, can conceive of, even in dream. So then he starts talking about uh, Darwin's theory, he hints on that, and then he talks of the progression, so how the Indian sages have classified the scientific progression of life from the invertebrate, then to the testiculus, or the shelly, then to the vertebrate, erect vertebrate. In other words, from fish species to like in between fish and land, then to then you know the different species of life, and then to animals, to birds, to beasts, like that. There's a different progression, and so then he points out. He said, so this is how these different incarnations and avatars of the Lord are coming. He said it's exactly in scientific progression. He said first you get the aquatics. He said so Krishna first comes as a fish, as a Matsya avatar. Then you get the in between. Then he comes as a tortoise. He's half the water and half in the land. Then as life is the more developed it gets, it becomes half man. You know, like ape and things like that. Ape man. He says then you get the Nrisingadev. He's half man, half lion. And then you kind of get human like, but not like mannequin, like dwarf man. So it's this is Vamana Dev. Then he comes as Vamana Dev. Then you get kind of a savage man. He says Parasaram. He goes around killing everyone. Then you get like a perfect man as Ramchandra. Then you get the really white, very wise man. Then that's Krishna. And then he goes on. He said these avatars are actually coming in. This is science, the scientific way the progression goes. How the and this professor is completely flabbergasted, and he can't he's completely blown out by everything he's asked. He's being smashed and smashed and smashed again on the strength of Bhagavatam. And so finally he says, I just listened to so many subtle truths in the science of philosophy and religion. Please, let me have a conception of these intricate matters. So now he's really begging, you know, give me... First he was really challenging, now he's really begging, please. And now at this point, in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says, the essential principle of Vaishnavism is that, however so-called great a scholar and intellectual giant a man may be, he will not be able to appreciate even the easiest points of the Vaishnava philosophy until and unless he has entirely surrendered himself to an Acharya whose character is the embodiment of Vaishnava philosophy. You must have heard about the Indian scripture named Gita. It has been translated into different languages of the civilized world, and there is a sloka in it, 434, which says that the Vaishnava philosophy is understandable only with unconditional surrender, honest inquiry, and a serving temper. It is only to such an approach the professors of Vaishnava philosophy, with these three as a preceptorial fee, they give instruction about the correct philosophical truth. These professors are never to be tempted by any type of worldly fees. So he's saying here, now he's really inquiring, he's saying, now, okay, now you're a bit serious, you're not challenging me, you're serious here. Now here is the process. And he's quoting Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, approach of bona fide spiritual master. These three things have got to be there. You've got to approach, you've got to surrender completely. Honestly inquire. And in the mood of service. Then, this is the fee. Approach it with humility, render service, and render quiet. These three things. No other fee is required. That is the fee. And if you don't do that, you're never, never, never going to understand. Then he cuts him off at that point. Okay, you want to go further? This is what you've got to do. Of course, the professor, he never actually became his disciple, but he actually glorified Bhaktisiddhanta. He was telling everyone how great a person he was. And that actually he came to Mayapur. He visited Mayapur also. So that was one great thing about him. But he really appreciated. But the point was that Bhaktisiddhanta was making that, you know, this is actually the essence of Bhagavatam. It answers all the questions so perfectly. And then there has to be the correct attitude of approaching Bhagavatam. Otherwise, no, you can't understand Bhagavatam. Without going through the Bhagavat devotee, you can't understand Bhagavatam. This is Devananda Pandit from Navadvip. He was, from his very birth, he was very austere, sober, he's very aloof from everything, brahmachari, so learned, peaceful. He had all good qualities. But actually he was studying Bhagavatam, and that's all he studied. And he recited Bhagavatam. And he had many, many followers. But the purpose of his studying was for liberation. He was using it as the process of liberation. Sava, kama, moksha, kama. Even if you want liberation, you should take the worship of Krishna. So he was worshipping Krishna, worshipping the Bhagavatam. But his objective was liberation. But he was very, very famous and very popular. Then one time, there was an incident when Srivas Thakur was walking past and he was hearing Bhagavatam, he was immediately attracted. So, Bhagavatam is full of nectar in every syllable, so Srivas Thakur, being a great devotee, he just sat there. He was hearing his Bhagavatam and he was just relishing it, like, and he began sighing and sobbing, couldn't control himself. Then the students of Devananda Pandit, who were simply they were studying for the sake of studying. They wanted to be academics, and they wanted their degree. So that's the only reason they were going. Just, you know, study Bhagavatam, get your degree, and, you know, wave your papers and things like that. They also weren't devotees, so they couldn't understand Srivas Thakur. So they said, he's making a disturbance. If he disturbs us, we won't pass our exams. If we don't hear properly, we won't get our degree. So they threw him outside. They took him outside. And Devananda Pandit saw this, but he didn't say anything. So that constituted a great Vaishnava Parad. Because he was supposed to be the teacher there. And he was supposed to be in knowledge. But because he didn't understand the aspect of devotion, then it didn't appear to him like a big thing. So so the idea is that even they're studying, they take the Srimad Bhagavatam as a means of mukti. Nobody can ever understand the real essence of Bhagavatam. Because it has to come, you have to learn it from a Bhagavat devotee. And Devananda Pandit, after he was favored by Bhakeshwar Pandit, who was staying there, and he started to preach to Devananda Pandit, actually the glories of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the Bhagavatam. And slowly, by the grace of Bhakeshwar Pandit, another great devotee, he actually realized his mistake, and then he became a great devotee of Lord Chaitanya. But previously, he can never understand. Because although they're using the Bhagavatam as a means of salvation, the Bhagavatam is... See, there's three things. There's Bhagavan, and there's the Bhagavata for the devotee, and there's Bhakti. These things, that relationship is there. If it's not there, then nothing will manifest from Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam is based on these principles. It's the book of Krishna and Krishna's devotees, and the relationship of the devotees between Krishna and Krishna and his devotees. So these three things are all that's there. And that is why it is bringing out bhakti. Because bhakti and Bhagavan, and the relationships are going, that's all that's going on in the Srimad Bhagavatam. But those who don't understand the point and they're using it for liberation, then they don't see the importance of bhakti, or they see it as an importance, it's just a means for their liberation, but not as an end, it's just a means. And also the bhakta doesn't have much mean, you know, but as a process you become a bhakta and you speak bhakti and you speak about Krishna, but actually it has no meaning because ultimately you really don't believe in bhakti or the bhakta, you only believe in Bhagavan. Because ultimately it's just Bhagavan. Your moksha is that, you know, you're going to become one with Bhagavan or, but whatever it is. But the idea is that it's only Bhagavan. Just like the Mayavadis, Om Narayana Namaha. They only see Narayana. They don't see the devotee or anyone else. You are Narayana, everything is Narayana. But that's not, there's no bhakti there. There has to be the bhakti and there has to be bhakti. Relationship. But they just know, no, everything is Bhagavan. So there's no bhakti and there's no bhakti. So Devananda had this same mentality. He just saw it as a process for liberation, and he only saw Bhagavan, but he didn't see the bhakti, and he didn't see bhakti. Therefore, how he could give it. But that's all that the Bhagavatam is saying. It's just bringing out this point of bhakti, which is the binding fact between the bhakta and Bhagavan. So anyway, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was going part through there one day, and he saw that the Devananda's pandit, and he was hearing him speaking. And he said, what can this person understand? He said, in all of his births, he's never understood Bhagavatam. He'll never understand Bhagavatam. This is the Vedas declare that the Bhagavatam, it's a manifestation of ecstatic love of Krishna. And anyone who discriminates between me or my servants or the Bhagavatam, he's destroyed. And this Devananda, he's discriminated between my devotee. He threw Shiva's Thakur out. He's seeing the difference between the Bhakta and Bhagavan. There's no difference. Bhakta, Bhagavan and Bhakti. Together, there's no difference. And separately, there's no meaning. But he's separating them. Therefore, he doesn't understand the meaning. He will never understand the meaning. And Mahaprabhu was actually very angry. He was shouting at Devananda Pandit. And then he told, you see, today I will go and tear up his books. I'm going to go and rip his books apart. You see, the devotee is at the whole Mahaprabhu back. Don't do that. People will get the wrong idea from you. And they will criticize you. So that's the idea, is that if you're using Bhagavatam just as a means of salvation, to go back to God, but misunderstanding the means, devotional service to Krishna is the means, and it's also the goal. Whereas the salvationists, they simply want to use it as a means, and when they achieve the goal, they don't need the means anymore. But the means and the goal are the same in devotional service. So this is what is being pointed out. So unless one is a devotee, then the message of Krishna won't go into his ear. And if a person is not a devotee, he's a salvationist, even like Devananda Pandit, Mahaprabhu was pointing out, actually he's still full of anarthas. Although he seems like a very pure brahmachari, the very fact that he's not accepting the process of bhakti means he's full of anarthas. Because he is thinking that ultimately bhakti is something that's not wanted. It's needed now as a practice till we get our liberation. After that, it's not wanted. So ultimately, Moksha means, and liberation means, actually there is no bhakti or process of bhakti. So it's an unwanted thing actually for the salvation. We'll use it till we get our salvation, but actually it's an unwanted thing. So that's in their heart. So although they appear to be free from all anarthas because they're very pure and brahmacharis, lifelong brahmacharis, and very learned and everything like that, he has the anartha of thinking that bhakti is an anartha in his heart. So he's keeping that anartha. So he can never be freed when he's got these anarthas. Unwanted thing. He thinks that actually ultimately bhakti is an unwanted thing. So he's keeping the anartha of thinking bhakti is an anartha in his heart. Therefore Chaitanya, he's never going to understand. And he said, actually, for the devotee, they understand that there's no difference between Krishna, Krishna's name, Krishna's devotee, and the process of bhakti. He said, then they can hear. They hear nicely. He said, then the words of Krishna, because Krishna and the Bhagavatam is non-different. Krishna and his words are non-different, it says here. Then that Krishna actually enters into their ears. And he pierces the ears. There's a samskara called the karana vada samskara. You know, when they pierce the ear, different samskaras that you go through. So the karana vada samskara, you pierce the ears. So this is the Vaishnavas, that they pierce the ear. They perform the karana vada samskara, pierce the ears. And that is, they understand and they listen intently that Bhagavatam is none different than Krishna. I'm Krishna's servant. And then actually Krishna enters into their ears and he pierces. He pierces all the dirt in the ear. And he goes through the dirt. And it goes right to the soul. And then they can understand. But the others who want moksha or anything else, or they're not devotees, they just have dirt in their ears. And all that hears, when they see anything in the Bhagavatam, they think, oh, it just goes on the dirt. And they think, well, it's material. You know, and then they read Krishna's pastimes. It just goes on the dirt. Krishna's pastimes with the gopis, it goes on the dirt. And what is it? It just simply agitates their heart. Because it doesn't pierce through. It goes on the covering of dirt. But the devotees, they do the karanavada samskara. They pierce the ears with the topics of Krishna Katha. Understanding is non-different. It goes right through that into the heart. And then it becomes manifest. Then he understands actually the heart is non-different than Vrindavan, and Vrindavan is where Krishna always lives. So then he understands the non-difference between Bhagavad Bhagavatam, the bhakta, and the process of bhakti. It's all on the Yasvi platform. So this is the science and of how to even to approach Bhagavatam, even before you hear it, the whole attitude that one has to develop. And Sukadeva Goswami is pointing out here, quoting his own example, and he's giving us kindly the actual process and to actually hear Bhagavatam. Then the hearing becomes much, then the realization will come much more quickly than if we approach in the proper attitude. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Srimad Prabhupada ki. Samaveda Bhakti Prindiki Hitaigo Primanandi. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions?
Can you speak to Devanandamati? I've heard from the Bhagavad Gita,
well, Lord Chaitanya forgave Devananda Pandit in that area. And I think also in that same area, he didn't he deliver Gopal Chapala from his offences? So it's a place, the area is a place where offences were given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So devotees, when they go in that area, then they take advantage of that locality and they fall in the dust and ask to be forgiven from all of their offences to the devotees, aparadas. Yeah, it's a fact. It's It's a potent, the whole area there, not just the, that moth, it's just, that moth is they're signifying the place of Devananda and glorifying. They've got the deity of him there also. But it means the whole area there, because Vidyanagar, that area, is also a, I think Gopal Chapala was to do with that. So.
Why? Why is that?
Huh?
Why is special that area?
Because that's where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu forgave Devananda. And maybe two other devotees. The one who had leprosy. They were in that area. So it's the area where the Lord was very merciful to the offenders. So I know, I'm a great offender, so I'm in this area, please. We're begging forgiveness from the Lord. There's another explanation. You want to give some other? Because the pastimes of the Lord are absolute, so that act is going on now, he's actually forgiving them, Devananda Pandit, right now. It's going on there right now. So why is he in that mood? You know, we're there, so we pray. Also forgive my offenses.
Does he get free from offenses without going to Sri Vaishnava for forgiveness?
Yeah, he had to. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, even I can't forgive anyone. And even Krishna makes that statement. I can't. You have to go to that person who you made an offense to, and he can forgive you. I couldn't save Ambarishi. He had to go back. I couldn't save the Vashamuni, he had to go back to Ambarish. Sachi Mata, she made an offense to Advaita Acharya. That Advaita Acharya, even just in her mind actually. He took my son away, the first son, Vishwarup. Vishnu only went to see Advaita Acharya because he was the only one speaking bhakti and everyone else was speaking dry logic. He was getting cheap. So he would only go and see Advaita. He associated with him so much. Then finally he took sannyas and left, and Sachimata said, because then the later Nimai started always associating. He said that Advaita Acharya took one of my sons away, now he's going to take the other one away. He's taken half my life, he's going to completely destroy me now. It was just in her mind. But because she made an offense to Advaita, then they asked Mahaprabhu, when he was, I think at the time of the Mahaprakash, he was showing his form of Vishnu. They said, give Mother Sachi Krishna frame. Give him. He said, no, I will not give my mother. I said, what? He made an offense to Advaita Acharya. Only if she takes the dust of the lotus feet of Advaita Acharya will she be forgiven of that offense. I cannot do anything. So then all devotees went to Advaita Acharya and said, give Mother Sachi the dust of your feet and then and forgive her for her offenses. And then she will get the love of Godhead. Krishna, Mahaprabhu will give her the service to Krishna. He said, Vishnu, 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 what are you saying? He said, she's the mother of the universe. She's my mother. She's maintaining me. I've become purified by taking the dust of her feet. And you want me to take my dust and put it on? And he fainted. And everyone said, now is the time to get it. Sachimata went running up on Acharya, was fainting as he put the dust at the feet. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, okay, now I will give. Still it was dependent on the Lord. But he said, because you've got now I will give. So that mercy is always dependent on the Lord. But he has to see that you have to go through a procedure to get his mercy.
You're saying in this area we can get relief from offenses to devotees. In that area of Devananda, Mahatma, place, we can get relief from offenses to devotees.
Yeah.
So we don't need to go to the devotee to get relief from offenses.
Not you're saying that you can go to the area there and we ask for forgiveness from any Vaishnava aparad. But then again, you're saying that you've got to go to the devotee. Devotee may not be there. You've got to go to the devotee and ask his blessing, forgiveness. Tricky question. Only you can answer, Maharaj. Anyway, you've got to get both. Chaitanya, after Satchimata got the blessings of Dasarath, then Chaitanya, okay, now I'll give my blessings of service to Krishna to you. So at least we can get that. Please give us a blessing and was it post-dated check? Then when we find that devotee, we'll pay our blessings, but you give your blessing now anyway for devotional service. Then when we meet that devotee, we'll get his blessings. Anyway, we can always pray for unknowing offenses, because there may be so many devotees we don't know. For those unknowing offenses, we can become remedied. Prabhupada ki. Thank you very much. Oh, it's the Mahaprasad here.